Well, good evening to everybody, and thank you to Jorge for inviting me to this interesting conference. My background is biology. I'm going to say that first. I'm not an archaeologist, I'm a physical anthropologist, and I have experience in forensic and archaeological contexts. I have worked in different countries. What I'm going to try is to look for the link between forensic anthropology and archaeology, as related to identity, identification, and otherness. And I will try to merge some concepts that come from, at first sight, different fields, but I think that they are very related and can be fruitful to compare the approaches from these different fields. How I see identity, which is not, of course, my specialty, is constructed by different variables. Not only this, and all are related and changing, so it's very dynamic. And it can be self-defined, can be defined by others, applied to groups, to individuals, so we have two levels moving. And then we have a post-mortem perspective. So we have very limited information. And this is from a forensic or from an archaeological context. So to me, the approach to these concepts are very interesting, but it's like very complex. Of course, you all know because you work on this, but to me, it's like, it sounds like this kind of lysergic slide. But I will say that from the point of view of archaeology, it has been based on the group, the identity of the group. Forensics has been based on the identification of the individual. But both concepts are related, and both disciplines also apply to identification of individual. And we have seen an example just now of the ring of this supposedly wife of a king. And also in forensic, the group identity is also analyzed, and we are going to see how is group identity analyzed. We are going to stay now with forensic and with group identity. Well, in forensic, group identity, one definition I have written here is a social construct which an individual's membership within a specific group can be self-proclaimed or perceived. And it is important in forensic anthropology in genocide investigations. This is the definition of genocide as the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. National group is defined by common country of nationality. Ethnic group shares common cultural traditions, language, or heritage. Racial group is defined by physical characteristics. A religious group shares common creeds, beliefs, doctrines, practice, or rituals. These are the definitions from the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. So, group identity is based on shared class characteristics. And these are questions that belonging to these groups is questions that has to be asked in international tribunals from information retrieved from mass graves, from forensic context. So, this is some debate about these concepts now in forensic anthropology. So is victim group identity a question of science? This is the first question. So it's like establishing victims group identity remains largely presumptive. In different cases, for example, in the former Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, it has been difficult. In some cases, it is straightforward due to some artifacts or personal objects recovered from the grave, but some places, many times it's difficult to establish group identity. And then if it can be approached from forensic anthropology, the scientific method would require that the victims of a specific act of genocide form a cohesive, defined group, distinct from the perpetrators and all other geographically relevant populations, and should not only be recognized within the society as a whole, but must also exist in a form verified through scientific observation and measurement of some features, so that forensic anthropological analysis of the remains and the context can say something about belonging to one of those groups. It should be measurable. Of course, we are talking about in a medical-legal context, and there is some troubles because what if victim identity is only a matter of law and the perpetrator's state of mind? So this is the question. Must prosecutors merely demonstrate that the perpetrators identify the victims as a group irrespective of whether the group self-identify as such or society share the perpetrator's definition. So it's like complex approaches for to try to answer the question if the remains of victims exhumed from a mass grave belong to a national group, a ethnic group, a racial group, a religious group, all the groups protected under genocide investigations. So it's kind of, it's not exactly the same question, but I think that it's interesting to see that from other disciplines is approaching the same question as in archaeology, talking about group identity. Of course, this context with these concepts, the four groups that are under protection in genocide investigations should be assessed within particular political, social, and cultural context. For example, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda found racial groups to be, and this is the definition, based on the hereditary physical traits often identified with a geographical region, respective of linguistic, cultural, national, or religious factors. So two ethnic groups that were involved in the Rwanda crimes where there has been discussion about physical differences between Tutsis and Hutus, for example, but there's no clear definition, and also the typological approach in physical anthropology is kind of the past. Although it can be approached, the kind of racial or ancestry identification. While ethnic group are those who share a common language and culture. So this is, for example, where the definitions of the ICT were. From physical anthropology, phenotypic variation in the skeleton can be associated to geographical origin, but it's better applied to samples of skeletons, not to individuals. So craniometry, dental morphology have been applied and have been tried, for example, in the former Yugoslavia. Some authors state that craniometry can distinguish between different specific geographic locations in the Balkans, or dental morphology, for example, in some other places like in Guatemala, dental morphology of the target population, which was the rural indigenous population, can maybe differentiate between those groups and other groups coming from cities. But it's difficult. It's a difficult approach from physical anthropology. And of course, there is some cases where the archaeological information can shed light on the nature of the victim identification. For example, I bring here some picture of remains found in a former cemetery, victims of the Spanish Civil War. And we can see that there is a formal burial, because they are individual burials in an order rows, but they are upside down. They are in prone position. So this indicates that these people were not treated like in a respectful way. They were treated as different. So this is, for example, this kind of information applied to individual or to groups can be interesting from the archaeological context. For example, inside the cemetery also, this is a case from the Spanish Civil War, from a massacre that took place in 1947. So this is inside the cemetery, a multiple disorderly burial. So of course, this is like a victim group. So it separates from the ordinary burials. Or I bring here some cases that we worked years ago in Guatemala. It's like we can see here like a family group buried in a mass grave, but it is a mass grave, but it's an ordered mass grave. And we see the skeleton on the right is an adult male skeleton. And once we recovered the skeleton, we found an offering. So it is this. There was a sign of premortem trauma in these skeletons. These persons were killed, but this offers information about undertakers and perpetrators, because these people were victims of civil patrols, which were paramilitary squads comprised of local people from the towns. So these people killed these persons, but allow relatives or known people to bury them. But if we look at mass graves where perpetrators were the army, the Guatemalan army, we can see they were thrown to water wells, or where they were disposed just in the typical mass grave. We call all the skeletons in disordered way. So we can have information about undertakers, perpetrators from this. This is like the classical information that we can extract to try to see victims' group identity. But there is one avenue that clarifies group identity. Not always, but sometimes. And it's if the victim is identified. If the victim is identified, then group identity is probably established in different contexts. So personal identification, I define like the act of establishing the decedent's name to a scientific degree of certainty through the comparison of antemortem data, fingerprints, dental records, morphological features, DNA, also other information that recovered from the grave, like personal objects, with evidence derived post-mortem. So this is the identification. So we change from identity to identification, and we have group of variables that can be estimated from the study of human remains, the classical sex, age, and stature, variants, pathology, ancestry, immigration history, diet, occupation. This is in the field of forensic anthropology, and also material, culture, status, occupation, diet, immigration history can be also approached from social, cultural anthropology. I'm talking in a forensic setting, when sometimes social and cultural anthropologists are very helpful in the identification process. Not helpful, but sometimes they are needed. So in comparison with group identification, which is based on shared class characteristics, personal identification relies on individualization through a life history or osteobiographical approach, which is focused on the individual, but is related to the other task of investigation of genocide, which is victim group identity. So there has been a recent and rapid improvement in methods for identification that have come not only from forensics but also from archaeology. This is like an overlapping field, and they are like feeding each other. So for all these variants, all these variables, we have DNA, which has had impact, of course, in identification, but also in ancestry, in sex estimation. For example, sex estimation sometimes is difficult from human skeletal remains, but more and more it is applied DNA to get sex estimation. It will be cheaper and cheaper also. Isotope studies, which I think has impacted most archaeology, by ancestry, migration history, diet, occupation, histology also, bone microstructure, also statistical new methods to treat the data. So we have like a rapid improvement in methods for identification. I'm talking about forensic anthropology, but this can also be applied to archaeology, because we are talking here about forensic, but if we translate to archaeology, the emphasis on the individual approach, paralleling identification in forensic anthropology and referred to as the bioarchaeology of individual life histories. And this is like, of course this has been building for a lot of years, but these two authors, Sebreville and Weaver, Sebreville died last year, they have this special issue in the Journal of Anthropological Archaeology when they basically talk about, gather information from these approaches, and they state like this is like the bioarchaeology of individual life histories. So it's interesting, it's like three or four papers accompanying this this introduction from these both authors. So archaeology that has relied on identity at the group level can also, and with the implementation of these new developments that have impacted specifically forensic anthropology, but can rely on the not the identification in terms of naming a deceased, but to take extract information out of the life history of the individual. That would be like an individual-based approach. So it's like the archaeology that can be, and I think probably will be merging both kinds of objectives, like at the group level and also at the individual level. So, I have brought some examples from specifically from isotope studies, which I think is the like most widely applied in archaeology, and has the most important impact in archaeology, I think, also in forensic anthropology. So I will show some examples of that have came from forensic studies. This is the distribution of isotopes, different isotopes of the hydrogen related to climate, zones, and altitude, and you cannot see, but it's like from left, from right to left is Costa Rica, Brazil, is Greece, Czech Republic, Poland, Lithuania, Denmark, Russia, Pakistan. So it's like a distribution of worldwide distribution of the sample. Food composition is the isotope of the carbon related to food consumption and type of plants, and we can see these different, very different distributions worldwide. The nitrogen, animal producing the diet, and the sulfur, seafood consumption, geological conditions also. So this is Like a lot of research has been done and is going on in forensics from this point of view to try to see the geographical origin of an unknown body. And so more and more reference data are built. Or for example, this one is like analysis of human hair to identify the recent migrants in a rural community in southwestern England. So we can see that they can identify migrants. This is a hair analysis in this community from the group. So this like it also relies on kind of a group approach, but we can see that this is possible to differentiate through multivariate analysis. And this has been applied to archaeology. I have brought just two examples. One example from archaeology in Japan, when they studied this small region in Japan, and they found that, contrary to what's believed from theory, in this is four types of dental modification, which are in here. And it was the initial hypothesis that was that one of the kinds of dental modification is excluded immigrants, but it was shown from strontium, from the local signature of strontium, from strontium isotope, and from the skeletons, that all dental modifications types presented immigrants. Local signature is in shallow. So, but there were some difference because this type 2C presented a lot of proportion of immigrants. So is this kind of methodology, for example, also from Guatemalan archaeology, Tikal's Project Burial. It was like the third indicator from epigraphic decipherments that the child of a Teotihuacan ruler from Mexico was installed as the ruler of Tikal in this year. But looking at this burial, they did strontium isotope ratios, and the results do not support epigraphic readings that identify this ruler as a child of Teotihuacan, which had some implications of polity between Mayan states and Teotihuacan. But this is, would be like at the group level, but also at the life history approach. What we can see here is a forensic example that is was an unknown corpse recovered in Germany. And they got, in this case, heavy element isotope lead. And then we have samples of this corpse from teeth and skull, from hair, and from local signature of the soil where this was found in Germany. So from the hair, which represented the last months of this person, in contrast with teeth and skull, which represented like the more of the life cycle of this person, the forensic scientists suggested that this person could come from Romania, which was the case, because also the teeth and skull isotope ratios were close, very close to a place in Romania where there was some mining. So this is like how they developed the life history approach to a corpse, because they can see where this person lived in different parts of his life. And I have brought this example from a Bronze Age near Stonehenge, where they found a burial with seven skeletons, and when they did the strontium isotope analysis on the second premolar and then the third molar. The second premolar is formed before the third molar. What we saw is that from three adults, these are the three adults, the second premolar is strontium ratio was here, the third premolar was here, but for the two juveniles, the second premolar strontium ratio was here. So they say that five skeletons shared in a burial, common burial. The three adults presented a migration history from early life, second premolar, to adolescence, third molar. And it was different from the strontium signature of the two juveniles that were inside the same grave. So this is also the kind of life history approach that allowed to unfold the history of the person through this kind of analysis. So these are the questions that can be now. I have shown the good examples because it's complicated. We have tried to define, differentiate, for example, here in Spain with oxygen isotopes to see if it is helpful in forensics. We are having negative results. For example, there is no resolution at this scale at the Iberian Peninsula, and this happened in other cases. But it's just to show the potential and how these both approaches can interrelate from forensic and from archaeology. But the question would be that some of these questions can be related to the individual level. So what the ancestry, where people were born, where they come from, where the diet was at different times of their lives, what their health was like, their lifestyle, activity patterns, how much they were, how did they die. And so this is like the crossing of this approach to the more established data provided by individual social status, roles, identities, based on mortuary right, burial goods, and cemetery spatial organization, is like will enrich the archaeology, the archaeological approach, from the group identity to an individual life history approach, not the identification, which is the forensic. But it's also like the same questions can be approached from archaeology and from forensics. From forensic, there is no clear solution to the question of genocide group identification. It is difficult, but there is now some research. But that kind of questions and approaches can and is now starting more and more be to approach to archaeology. So that's it.